And now on The Nightlife, to our annual look at some of the events happening in Australia next year. We'll find out about a very interesting, well, I suppose, play, acting performance, you might call it, at the Sydney Festival. We'll also find out about what is in store in Canberra as our nation's capital celebrates its 100th birthday next year. But first, to the major artistic event of 2013 in Australia. It's the spectacular staging of Wagner's Ring Cycle by Opera Australia, and it will take place in Melbourne in November next year. So here to talk about it is the Artistic Director of Opera Australia, Lyndon Terracini. Lyndon, a very good evening and welcome to The Nightlife.
It's great to be here, Rod.
Tell me first, what is The Ring Cycle? For those who may not know too much more about it than just the name, what is it?
Well, it's a piece that consists of four operas, some of them quite long, that Richard Wagner wrote. He wrote the text and the music, and he was very specific about the stage directions as well. It took him virtually a lifetime to write, and he was fortunate enough to encounter King Ludwig of Bavaria, who Wagner somehow talked King Ludwig into building him a theatre, which is Bayreuth in Germany. And every year, Wagner's operas are performed there. It was built to Wagner's specifications, and that is, there's a lot of wood in the theatre and the pit is covered and so on and so on. And Wagner actually wanted that his operas would only be performed there. But of course, they became incredibly popular, and The Ring in particular. And so The Ring is now, and so most of his other operas, performed in opera houses through most of the world. But we at Opera Australia are doing it for the first time next year in Melbourne at the Victorian Arts Centre. The whole Ring lasts about 16 hours, and Wagner's intention was that you would see it on consecutive days. Well, because he wrote such incredibly demanding music, it's impossible to do it with the same cast in four consecutive days. People who see it usually form this incredible fascination for it, and people who can afford to do so will follow it around the world and see productions whenever they can in different cities in the world. I know several people, one in particular, a lady who lives in Sydney, has seen The Ring, the complete Ring Cycle, more than 60 times.
Wow.
It is this extraordinary thing that you can find different things in it, obviously when there are different productions. But some of the music is some of the greatest music that's ever been written. And probably The Ring Cycle itself is one of the great, the most important pieces of music, theatre, music, drama, ever written, and an absolute pillar of Western musical culture. It's the end of Die Walküre, which are the Valkyries, which is the second opera in the cycle, is some of the most beautiful music that you'll ever hear. And I remember being at the Metropolitan Opera in New York, and Valery Gergiev, the great Russian conductor, had brought his production from St. Petersburg with wonderful singers. And I remember sitting there that evening, and we got to the end of Die Walküre, and I just thought it was absolutely one of the most glorious experiences I'd ever had.
Wow.
It takes really superhuman voices to be able to sing it, particularly Siegfried. And in fact, Wagner actually invented a voice type that he called the Helden tenor, the heroic tenor. And Siegfried sings for, well, that opera, the third opera in the cycle, Siegfried, is about 6 hours long. And he sings for most of those 6 hours. And for most of it, it's in the uppermost part of his voice. And so it's extremely tiring. And there are very, very, very few people who can actually physically get through the role of Siegfried, let alone sing it and make it sound beautiful. It's incredibly taxing. For Wotan too, the great god Wotan, there's a lot to sing. And Brunhilde, she has an enormous amount to sing that's very, very demanding. So it's, for singers particularly, it's very difficult. And for any opera company, it's sort of like the Olympics of opera and classical music. Now, the story is very convoluted with gods and the Rhine maidens and the Valkyries and the dwarves, and everyone is fighting over who will have the gold ring of the Nibelungs. And there are many very different interpretations of that. The one we're doing in Melbourne, Neil Armfield is the director, and he has a particular interpretation on that. It's conducted by Richard Mills, and it's the first time ever that there has been an Australian creative team producing an entire Ring cycle. There are so many facets and aspects of the Ring, and so many different opinions about it and different ways to do it, that it remains a piece that just phenomenally fascinating to a large number of people who, as I said, will get on a plane and just fly to see another performance of the entire Ring cycle. I've seen the Ring, oh, I guess, about four or five times. There is certainly something about it that keeps drawing you in and drawing you back to it. And I must say, when you are sitting in the theatre for Siegfried or Goethe Dämmerung, which is almost as long as Siegfried, it doesn't seem like 6 hours. You know, you do have meal breaks, so you go out and have something to eat, and everyone will have an opinion on who's been cast as Siegfried or Wotan or Alberich, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And the Wagnerians tend to be even more extreme than the usual opera goers. And, of course, opera goers have opinions about absolutely everything that's related to opera. But the Wagnerians, they get pretty volatile about all sorts of things. And they're not afraid to stand up and boo and yell really? If they don't like it. And it's a very, very special kind of focus that you have on something, on a work of art like this. I can't think of anything else, either in painting, visual arts or music, that has anything like that sort of response to an audience.
So because there are four operas and because it goes for maybe 16 hours, how many times can you even perform each opera?
Well, we're doing three cycles.
The entire Ring cycle three times.
That's right. And there are some people that are coming to the three cycles, to every performance. The singers need often a couple of days rest between each performance. As I said, it's tremendously demanding, particularly for Siegfried. And, you know, if the Siegfried can't sing it, then it's not only a very, very long night in the theatre for him, but it also is for the audience too.
Yeah, I can imagine.
When, you know, someone is really having great difficulty in getting the notes and that goes on for 6 hours, it's not a particularly pleasant experience. But fortunately, we've got a sensational tenor. His name is Stefan Finke. He's got vocal cords of steel, I think, because he's almost indestructible. And he's just sung Siegfried at Covent Garden in London in the Ring cycle there and had a great success. And so he'll be doing it for us in Melbourne. I mean, we have a fantastic cast with Susan Bullock and Terje Stensfeldt and the wonderful Australian-based baritone John Wegner are singing Ulbricht. It's a terrific cast. But for every singer who does sing one of these major roles in the Ring, it's something that they treasure for the rest of their lives.
So is it something that generally couldn't be performed by Opera Australia because we don't have those singers in Opera Australia?
Look, I don't think there's any opera company in the world that could just cast the Ring from the rank and file members of the company.
There are, in fact, there are singers who go around the world only performing Wagner.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And particularly if you're a genuine Siegfried, then everyone in the world wants you to sing that in their theatre. Brunhilde too, you know, it's particularly demanding. And the great Wotans as well. They're all difficult. The orchestra too is enormous. The pit has been enlarged at the Victorian Arts Centre so that we'll be able to have 110 players in there, which is what you need for the Ring, and that's the first time ever in Australia that the Ring will be played with the full orchestration. And Wagner, in fact, invented some instruments. He was an extraordinary character. He wasn't satisfied with normal instruments, so he invented the Wagner tuba, that's what it's called today. It's the Wagner tuba, and so we've had to purchase some Wagner tubas so that they can be played in this production. But it was really his, genius, I guess. I hate using the word, but in Wagner's case, I think it's true, as it was with Mozart and Bach. He had this incredible vision for this piece that took him most of his life to realise, and even to the point, as I said, of inventing instruments, because he didn't feel that the right orchestral colour that he could find in a normal orchestra was there. So he invented the Wagner tubas, invented a particular type of voice, the Helden tenor, that didn't exist until Wagner came along. Also with some of the roles like Albrecht, you know, and Telramund, which is in another opera in Lohengrin, that Helden baritone voice, which is specific for those Wagner operas. And so Wagner had a monumental effect on music making, on the way we saw and viewed and listened to opera, because until that time, you know, you would hear an aria and then some recitative and then another aria and some recitative or an ensemble. Wagner wanted to create music drama. So there are no set arias in the Ring. It just, the music just flows and the narrative is carried by all of the singing. So he wrote music dramas, not operas. But within contemporary speak, we refer to them as operas.
How important is it that Opera Australia does perform this? I know we have a worldwide reputation with Opera Australia, of course, but to really place the company on the world stage, to be able to perform the Ring Cycle, how important is it?
I think it's vitally important because I guess it's like, well, it's like a football team. If the football team has never won a premiership, there's always a sense of frustration or disappointment. So for an opera company that has any sort of pretensions at being an international company, at some point in time, you've got to take the bull by the horns and actually say, well, we've got to do the Ring. We need to do the Ring. And not only for the sense of achievement, but to the way that people develop as artists, as singers and musicians, when you do actually have to take on that challenge of playing or singing something like that, and for directors too and conductors, to be able to do it, it's such an enormous challenge. If you can get there, if you can create magic within the time that you're not only performing it, but learning it, preparing it, then your ability to perform as an artist increases enormously. And I can see it myself in the company. A number of the singers have improved so much, even though at this stage they're still only learning the music. And I know that growth will go on. And that also applies to the people who are covering the roles, because obviously we need to have people in reserve in case someone gets sick. And so we have a lot of the singers in the company are covering the, some of the roles. Mm. And to hear the progress that they've made, even though they will only get the chance to perform if someone's ill, it's fantastic. And that is a wonderful thing, not only for them in terms of their development as singers, but it's a wonderful thing for the company too, where we can call on singers that have really progressed so tremendously that they'll become an even more important part of Opera Australia.
What about the artistic director? How have you grown? Because I can imagine that this is always a dream of any serious opera company, that they would like to present the Ring. How long ago did you come up with the idea, or did somebody come to you with the idea? And then how long between that and when you thought it might actually be a realistic possibility?
Well, I guess it began when I was first interviewed for the position by the board of Opera Australia, and they asked me what I thought we should be doing, and I said, well, we need to do the Ring.
Wow.
And so then when they offered me the job, I thought, oh, gee, I suppose we have to do it. But I was very, very fortunate in that there's a wonderful woman who lives in Melbourne with her husband, Maureen and Tony Wheeler. And Maureen is a great Wagner aficionado. And she offered to contribute a large amount of money to sponsor the Ring in Melbourne. And without Maureen, then it certainly wouldn't have happened, because as you can imagine, it's not a cheap exercise.
Indeed.
And so with all of these things, you can be determined to do something, but unless you have a little bit of luck along the way with anything, you'll miss out. But unfortunately, Maureen was there, and she was eager to see the Ring happen in Melbourne, and so contributed this very, very generous sponsorship.
And is that why it's in Melbourne? Because I know there's always the battle of where these things are produced, and there's been an ongoing controversy about the size of the orchestra pit at the Opera House in Sydney, and obviously the way you've described it, there's no chance in the wide world that you could have had the orchestra for the Ring Cycle in the orchestra pit in Sydney. Is this now a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for people in Australia to see this? I know it's been performed in Adelaide before, but not by Opera Australia. Is this really the once-in-a-lifetime for Opera Australia?
Well, I hope not, and you're right. Well, a couple of things. Firstly, Maureen's generous donation is a very important reason to do it in Melbourne, but also the theatre and the pit are of a substantial size so that we can do it in Melbourne. I mean, there's an old a joke that goes around in the industry that there's one great opera house in Australia. The outside is in Sydney, the inside is in Melbourne, and the car park's in Adelaide. I'm not sure that that's totally true, but certainly Melbourne is a fantastic theatre, and now with the pit being enlarged even more to cater for this Wagnerian orchestra, it'll be a tremendous experience. We hope to do it every 3 years, only in Melbourne. I'm hopeful that will happen so that we set up this tradition of the ring in Melbourne. But also in the years when we're not doing the ring, in Melbourne in our spring season, we're doing one big Strauss or big Wagner opera. So, for example, this year we're doing Salome. We did do it in Sydney. But next year we are doing, obviously, The Ring. And then in 2014 it will be another very large-scale Strauss opera. And ideally in 2015 a different Wagner opera. Then in 2016 we'll do The Ring again.
There was some controversy about the ticketing. If people want to go and see The Ring cycle, is that still going to be a possibility?
Well, at the moment it's sold out, but we do have a waiting list. And, of course, things change. Sometimes people at the last minute aren't able to come. Mm. But at the moment, yes, we've sold every ticket that we've got. But if people are interested in coming to see it, I would certainly ring and put your name on the waiting list, because you never know. Things can change, and particularly if people are travelling internationally, all sorts of things can occur. And if you've got your name there on the waiting list and something does happen, then you could very well find that you had a ticket to The Ring.
These days, though, it's not uncommon at all for operas, ballets, plays even, to be filmed and screened into cinemas around the world, certainly in Australia. Is that something that, if not a possibility this time, then maybe a possibility next time?
We're still looking at it this time. It's almost impossible for us to film the performances live because the cameras take up so much room and we've sold all the seats. But we're looking at the possibility of being able to film the general rehearsals or a stage rehearsal or something like that. So who knows? But hopefully we'll be able to have this production recorded and then broadcast into cinemas or to television.
When does it start?
Oh, it starts in November and runs through till the middle of December.
Okay, so almost a year. Are you going to be able to keep a lid on your excitement for a year? I mean, there's work you've got to do, I know, between now and then, but you must want it to start tomorrow.
Oh, look, in all sorts of ways we do, but there's still a huge amount of work to do, and everyone's got their heads down at the moment and working tremendously hard, because it is one of those experiences that everyone wants to work on The Ring, and everyone wants to, who works in this business, wants to feel that they can say to their children or their grandchildren, well, I worked on The Ring cycle in Melbourne in 2013, and it was special.
Lyndon, thank you so much, and the very best of luck with it.
Thank you very much, Rod. Lovely to talk to you.
Lyndon Terracini, Artistic Director of Opera Australia. You're with Rod Quinn. This is The Nightlife, and we're looking ahead to three events happening in Australia next year. Well, The Ring cycle takes place in Melbourne in November next year. The next event takes place in Canberra throughout 2013. It is the celebration of the centenary of the capital city of this nation. Here to tell us about it from Canberra 100 is Jeremy Lassick. Jeremy, a very good evening and welcome to The Nightlife.
Good evening, Rod. Good to be with you.
Thank you. What are we actually celebrating in Canberra next year?
Yes, well, on the 12th of March in 2013, we're celebrating exactly 100 years since Lady Denman stood on top of the foundation stone in a dusty paddock in what was to become Canberra, and she announced to a jubilant crowd on a very hot March day that the new national capital of Australia will be called Canberra. So it's 100 years exactly on the 12th of March next year.
Anyone who's lived in Canberra knows that Canberrans or Canberra is a place that loves its history. And there's a lot of history pre-1913 and then post that. But what you're planning for 2013 is not just a look back at history. You've got some unbelievable stuff planned. In fact, you've been planning this for nearly 10 years, haven't you?
No, you're right, Rod. It's a remarkable program. Just over 3 years ago, we appointed Robin Archer to lead the charge with the planning. So she's provided that sort of curatorial value. And the program's pretty much a 12-month program. In her first months with us, Robin looked at what already happens in Canberra as a matter of course each year, and she was quite blown away with what happens at our wonderful cultural institutions and our local galleries and institutions, what happens in a sporting sense in Canberra, and she was quite amazed, and she pretty much said, well, I think we've got the makings of an amazing year. If we can put some icing on the top, and really that's where Robin came in, playing that role of gluing the whole year together. And so very early she decided we won't do a week or a month and have a festival and here today, gone tomorrow. We'll make it a year. And by doing that, it means we can invite all Australians to Canberra at any time through the year. In fact, one of Robin's lines is pretty much any time in 2013 is a good time to come to Canberra because there's just so much on from go to woe.
Let's start with some of the sporting events.
We've already landed our first one-day international featuring Australia. We're thrilled and we're pleased that they've agreed for us to host the West Indies in early February at Manuka Oval. And one of the important things and one of the things we're trying to achieve through 2013 and our centenary is to create lasting legacies. And one early one is we will have lights up at Manuka and that allows us to play day-night cricket. It allows us to play twilight or evening AFL. Those lights are basically going up as we speak, and the PM's 11, which is against the West Indies, also in late January, and that'll be Ricky Ponting's final big hurrah, I suppose, after his announcement recently about his departure from cricket. And that'll be the first test, and then the first test of the lights, that is, not the first test match. And then, of course, the West Indies and Australia in a one-day international. Later that month, in mid-February, we've got the Australian Women's Golf Open at Royal Canberra. And again, that's a first, and we're expecting the majority of the world's top 20 to be in Canberra for that tournament. The richest prize money that's been offered in Australia for a women's tournament. Royal Canberra, as you know, Rod, is just a superb venue compared to Augusta in the States.
Yes, Australia's Augusta, they call it.
We're excited because the telecast will go to 70 or 80 countries around the world.
And it is a big year for women's sport in Canberra.
Yes.
You've got a lot of things planned.
We do. We've got the Australian and New Zealand women's netball teams playing in Canberra. That's another first. And anyone who follows sport knows that those two teams over the last decade have just, they've been some of the great sporting contests ever. So we're thrilled again that Netball Australia recognised the importance of our centenary and agreed to bring a game in that series to Canberra, which normally wouldn't happen because our venue is too small at the Institute of Sport. And Rugby League, they've agreed to put the only test match on next year again. The two top teams in the world, Australia and New Zealand, at Canberra Stadium in mid-April.
Who could ask for anything more? Jeremy Lassick is telling us what is planned for Canberra next year as Canberra celebrates 100 years. What about on the cultural, the artistic front?
It really starts with the National Gallery, Toulouse-Lautrec. That's going to be a blockbuster in itself. That runs right through to April, so for the start of the centenary. We've got some special commissions. Parliament House turns 25 next year, some of us still call the new Parliament House,
right,
but it turns 25, which is amazing. 1988 it opened. We've been working with Parliament House and with the Australian Ballet to commission a ballet about the architecture of Parliament House. Bizarre,
wow.
Sounds weird to me, but they're very excited at the ballet, and of course Parliament House is excited to see just what they come up with. That's happening in May, which in 2013, which is coinciding with that 25th anniversary. We've got Andrew Schultz, a terrific Australian composer, working on a special symphony for the centenary, which it's finalised. It's a grand piece. It involves some words that were written or spoken by Burley Griffin and others way back when, and choirs, local choirs, mass choirs, with the symphony in Canberra, which is just a magnificent orchestra these days under Nicholas Milton, and that will be world premiered on our big birthday celebration, which next year is on the 11th of March on and around Lake Burley Griffin, and that will be part of the finale. Robin's worked with the state arts and the Northern Territory arts communities to bring to the Canberra Theatre next year the very best piece of theatre or dance that is being shown across the nation next year in a collection called Collected Works Australia 2013. So Canberra Theatre, again, a series of firsts, but it's having its biggest season since it opened, and that goes back now more than 40 years, and it showcases, as it should in the national capital for a national celebration like the centenary, the very best of the arts from around the nation. Indigenous culture, we've got in February, and again around July, around NAIDOC week, some amazing performance art, especially from all over remote Australia, from the Pilbara, from the Tiwi Islands and other places, coming to Canberra next year. And these people we are bringing in from interstate, we're having collaboration with our local in the terms of the Indigenous cultural activities. Our local Indigenous community will work with them and receive mentoring, and the same with some of the theatre that comes in. And we've asked with the female golfers who come in that when they have that little bit of time off that they do have, that they run some clinics with some of our junior golfers. So we're trying to create legacies as best we can. So right across the year, from start to finish, there's just not a day, certainly not a weekend, where there isn't something exciting and really something for everyone across arts, yeah. culture, sport, science, even a series of amazing lectures and talks that Dave Heaton, our history advisor, is pulling together. Again, we have an amazing series of lectures all year, but under Big Issues, Big Talk, David's really umbrellaing them and again, bringing in some extra speakers through the year to create an amazing program that starts in January and runs right through to December. So it should be, you know, should be fantastic.
I mean, that's an unbelievable amount of stuff. And despite all the things you've mentioned, that is just the tip of the iceberg. That is just touching the surface. Because people think that Canberra is this boring place full of politicians and public servants. It's not. It has a really quirky history, especially a really quirky social history. Tell me about Kick Up Your Heels.
Yeah, it's a ripper of an event. Robin again recognises that, I think in all communities around Australia, dance is so special and has been special and still is for young and for old. But what we're doing right through for the 10 months from February is a decade of dance. So dancing through the decades. So starting, I think, at the Yarralumla Woolshed, which is a beautiful old structure. It'll be dancing through the decades, so featuring the music and the dance and the styles, probably even the food will be served from the different decades through the years. So as the year goes on, we'll get into Jitterbug and so on, and then into the rock and roll era of the 50s, probably a bit of the twist and swing through those eras. 70s was, well, we all know Elton John and disco. Mm-hmm. So, and then into the 80s, and the 80s was sort of big hair. The guys pulling that program together are having a huge amount of fun. And again, it's connecting our community. And we want young people to go to the 20s and 30s event. We don't want it to be a bunch of oldies just going to the older events. We really want the whole community to embrace the whole program, and we're looking for venues that that have a connection. And the beautiful Albert Hall down there off Commonwealth Avenue, it was the dancing scene for probably 40 years in Canberra, so it will be front and centre. And it's a place that isn't used enough, but in the centenary we're going to make sure it really comes back to life and is filled with fantastic memories and wonderful music and dance from those eras.
There's also other, again, quirky little things. The history of BMA, which is the street press, stands for Bands, Music, Action. There's going to be something to do with that as well.
Yes, you're right. It's been, I guess, the street culture, more of a youth element, but you know, even an old bloke like me enjoys picking up the BMA and flicking through. But it's been around for 20 or more years now, and we've thrown a little bit of money at a number of community groups. In fact, 51 community groups have received a small amount of money, or in some cases a larger amount, to run an activity or a project that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do. And BMA, yes, they're putting together a collection, a retrospective of the history of BMA, a wonderful collection from over the years. We've got the cake decorators in Canberra. They wanted to do something special, and we were happy to be able to support them. And again, not a lot of money. And then some larger grants to the Canberra Show, which is you know, one of the major events in Canberra in late February every year. And they wanted to be able to spend a little bit of money that we could provide through that fund to really go back to the old days of what the show looked like in Canberra's early years. So I guess making Sideshow Alley look a little bit like it might have done way back in the early years. I think there might be a boxing tent, but a whole bunch of things at the show to take us back. And the National Trust put a bid forward for a major car rally, and it's shaping up now as one of the biggest car rallies ever seen in Australia. It will link our port at Jervis Bay, and a lot of people wouldn't realise Canberra or the ACT has a coastal connection, and that goes way back. And so starting down at HMAS Creswell at Jervis Bay, well over 1,000 cars, most of them vintage cars, will work their way up through Braidwood and Bungendore into Canberra, and that will happen in October next year, and that will be an important part of an event we've created for next year called Spin, Canberra's Weekends on Wheels. Originally it was going to be about one weekend, but so many fantastic ideas, and people got so excited about Canberra's connection to the wheel, because those of us who've lived here or visited here know we're pretty crazy about our cars, and we know that in January with summer nats, of course. So we're putting together anything to do with wheels, and it's not just cars and skateboards and buses and shopping trolleys. It gets on down to spinning wheels. We're even looking at spin bowling and and maybe even just a little bit of political spin, which Canberra's probably most famous for. So look out for more details of that closer to October. But that should be fantastic. And, of course, that big rally means we get our local communities from Jervis Bay through coming up the mountain to Canberra involved as well, because I'm sure they'll be lining the streets to cheer those vehicles on as they pass through.
There's the National Folk Festival. There's the famous Spiegel Tent. You mentioned Summer Nats as well. There's just something for everyone. It really is something that has taken a lot of thought, and it's almost like you've said yes to just about everything.
Well, we've tried to, within reason, of course. There have been thousands of ideas that have come up. Some have been achievable, some not. But as I said earlier, we're looking at legacy. So one of the projects we funded was with the Scouts, and they wanted to train Scouts how to fly hot air balloons. And we thought Canberra's got such a connection with the ballooning community. And, of course, in March, we have our Balloon Spectacular. And we want to make sure that Canberra remains at the forefront of ballooning. And to be able to help the Scouts, basically, we funded a balloon, and they're organising training programs, which are now underway. The balloon's already airborne, beautifully branded with the Scouts and the Centenary, and that's a great legacy, because it means hopefully in the future we've got young people who take an active interest in ballooning, having done the training, and we continue to remain a ballooning capital of Australia and one of the ballooning capitals of the world. And another fantastic legacy, Rod, one that has had some controversy over the years, is the National Arboretum. Will be officially opened at the very start of February next year, and I was at an opera in the Arboretum last week, so while it's not officially opened, occasionally it's opened up for special events, and we had Sumi Jo, one of the world great opera singers from Korea. She came and performed to getting on for 5,000 people, and the venue is spectacular. There's a new visitor centre and function centre that's almost finished, and it is amazing architecturally. I'm sure it'll clean up a lot of architectural awards next year. We've got 84 of the 100 forests already planted, and many of these forests are endangered species from around the world, which can survive in Canberra, and it's going to be for Canberra and for the nation, a fantastic new attraction. It'll bring tourists from Australia and around the world. And it was a vision of, I must say, of John Stanhope, our previous chief minister, who was determined with others to leave a legacy from those 2003 bushfires. I think we all remember around the nation how bad and how sad that was at the time. And out of the fires and a burnt out pine forest that was on this site, 250 hectare site, so it's enormous. It was decided to create something special, something new, and something significant that probably won't be at its best for another 100 years. So some of the species planted have a life of 1,000 years, and in 100 years they'll still be very young trees. Others are growing beautifully, and they're already 5 or 6 metres high, having been planted 3 or 4 years ago. So that's just a remarkable legacy project, which we're hugely excited about.
That's something to celebrate. For the next 100 years, people will look back to the opening of the Arboretum then, I'm sure.
It's a celebration. It's a moment for the nation. It's not a Canberra thing. Yep. And it's great to be able to talk with you tonight, Rod, because we really want everyone in the nation to know and remind them that it's their capital as much as it is ours, the people who live here. And please get on the website, look at the program, find something that's of interest and attraction to you, and book in a visit for next year, because it's just going to be a great year.
There's books being written, there are films being made as well. And that website, Jeremy, is?
It's Canberra 100, and it's the number 100.com.au, Canberra 100.com.au. We're also, believe it or not, running something called Like Canberra. So if you go on the Like Canberra website, especially for those of you in Canberra, it's a fantastic initiative. We're just about at the 10,000 likes that people like about Canberra. What we're putting together, Rod, is a whole list of things that people have nominated about what they like about Canberra. And at the start of the centenary in 2013, we'll have a democratic, as you should in Canberra, a vote for the 100 things people like most about Canberra, and we'll then promote those. A bit of a toolkit for Canberrans when they travel outside of Canberra. Oh, what's to like about Canberra? Well, they can pull out their little ready reckoner and bore people stupid with the 100 things that we like most. So they were having a lot of fun with that too.
Jeremy, happy birthday and thanks very much.
Great talking to you. Thanks for the opportunity, Rod. It's been great.
Jeremy Lassick from Canberra 100. You're with Rod Quinn. This is The Nightlife, and we've gone big so far tonight. We've gone to the capital of the country and events that take place throughout the year. We've heard about the Ring Cycle, the greatest production that an opera company can stage. Now to something a lot smaller than those two, but no less fascinating. It's called the Blind Date Project. And it's an acting performance, an artistic performance, you might say, involving just two people. It doesn't take place in a theatre, it takes place in a karaoke bar. And the woman behind it, who plays the starring role, is one of Australia's leading young actresses. Her name is Bojana Novaković. And Bojana, good evening and welcome to the program.
Good evening.
You're about to go on dates with up to 17 men.
Well, all women.
All women.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how it came about. Where did the idea come from? Because it's a brilliant idea.
The idea came very accidentally out of an act of desperation. Last year I hadn't been on stage for over 2 years, and I was about to go on stage doing a main stage show at the Malt House, which I had written for me and myself and Tim Rogers to perform in. And during a coffee with a friend, I had a mini anxiety attack, and I said, I have to do something before I go on stage with this show. I decided that I would create a show with him that didn't require any scripts, and that could just be two people improvising with a bit of music. So all these criteria, I put them all together and created this thing called the Blind Date Project, which involves me going on a blind date with a man in a karaoke bar.
With a man?
Or a woman.
So you don't know, this is the lovely part of it, you don't know until they walk through the door who it is. And in fact, even then you may not necessarily know.
That's right. Sometimes I don't know the identity of the actor even when I see them. I don't know who those people are. Yes.
Now, it doesn't take place in a theatre, does it?
No, it takes place in a bar. I think we seat about 100 people at the bar or in the bar or around the bar, wherever. It's a karaoke venue. You literally walk into a karaoke venue and you can sing if you want to.
So are you looking around to see who it might be, or do you know that they're going to come through a certain door at a certain time?
I don't know what's going to happen because it's up to Tanya, who's directing the show, to decide that with the guest performer. Although most of the time there is a certain sort of ritual that happens at the beginning, which that I sit at the bar and the audience walks in. Some people ask me if I want a drink. By accident, they don't know that I'm part of the show. They just think I'm a lonely girl at the bar, which is great. And then at some point, the lights kind of change and I sort of know it's going to start. But most of the time, I have my head inside a newspaper trying to fill out the nine-letter word or figure out the nine-letter word so I don't have to focus on the sheer terror ahead of me.
I find it amazing that at a time when you were looking for something to do on stage, you chose something where you had no control over what happened.
Yes, I find it amazing too. I didn't know what I was getting into.
So the person walks in. There's no script. A lot of actors are really afraid of improvisation.
Yes, sir, they are.
Are you?
No, I love it.
Okay.
I actually prefer it than having a script. But we have a structure. There's a very finely worked out structure that supports all the action no matter what happens. And so if things go wrong, and inevitably they do, and they should, that is always supported by us having worked out lots of different possibilities about where the show can go. And it is structured to be a piece of theatre. So it's not,
sure,
you're not just watching a blind date that could ostensibly be or possibly be boring.
Yeah.
You're watching something that will be exciting because conflict is created and there is a piece of theatre in front of you.
Okay, so you work it out with the director. Meanwhile, the director is working it out with the other actor that you don't know about. So you don't necessarily know what direction they're getting, or do you know?
No, I don't work anything out with the director. I don't know any more than the other actor, except for I do understand the structure because I created it.
Yeah.
I understand where the piece needs to hit certain things, such as a bit of conflict here, mm-hmm, or a climax here or whatever, but I don't actually know what's going to happen when. I have no control over that.
So does the other actor, your blind date, have more control over what's going to happen?
They have even less control because they don't even know when the conflict's meant to start or when the climax is meant to happen. But the way that we are guided is via text messages and phone calls. So we have our telephones at the bar with us and the director sends through texts or calls us and gives us certain directions.
Like what?
There's been everything from talk about your family to take your underwear off. And anything in between. So the most obviously kind of comical one is try and kiss him. I get that. And then he gets whatever you do, do not let her kiss you. And so you have this sort of terribly awkward and very funny moment or elongated moment, depending on how long the director chooses to elongate that moment.
Have you been on many blind dates?
I've only ever been on one blind date.
How did it go?
It was amazing.
Really?
It lasted 3 days, yes.
Wow.
Yes.
And that, what, turned you off them for the rest of your
life?
Yeah,
and then we went on a second date and we never saw each other again. Yeah. But if you think about how you've been on first dates, right?
Of course.
Yeah. We don't really have a dating culture in Australia. No. There's a big dating culture in America. And we've done the show there a couple of times and it's a very different show. Yeah, I've been on a couple of dates, but they've been really boring. This is not a boring date, I promise. This is like one of the most eventfully exciting dates you'll ever see, because every time something happens that is unexpected for me and the other person.
But is the show different every single night?
Yes, sir.
In that you don't repeat a line of dialogue?
Well, I don't invent any dialogue, but I might accidentally say something that I said the night before.
You might occasionally, though, come up with something you think, boy, that's a good line, I'll use that again, and try and work it into the conversation?
I've done that before, but it gets tedious and it gets a bit boring, so we stop. Like, there's a joke that I've told a couple of times in a couple of the dates, and there's a couple of games, that I like to play with the dates just to get them loosened up and, you know, a couple of mind games and things like that. But other than that, there isn't any written lines, no. And in fact, during the date at some point, I'll inevitably talk about love, and I purposely decided not to script that for myself. I thought it would be a really great idea to write a great piece and make it sound really natural every night and do the same thing, but it changes every night.
But at least you know what you're getting yourself in for. The other actor has less idea.
That's right.
How do you convince them to be part of it? But you don't actually have to convince them because you don't want to know who it is.
Well, I don't have anything to do with that. Yeah. So I don't know how difficult or easy it is to convince the other actor. I do think that people are thrilled to be asked, probably, I hope. Yeah. Because I would be. I would be really, really thrilled to be asked to go on a blind date during the Sydney Festival. But also, I think people like the challenge. Like, actors like a challenge that we like doing what we're scared of. We like doing things that frighten us, and we like doing things that we can't do to prove to ourselves that we can do them.
Yeah.
And so this might fall into one of those categories.
Is there a list of actors that you do not wish to work with?
Yes, sir, there is.
And has that list been given to the director, who then rubs their hands together with glee and signs every one of them up?
I don't know. I won't know until I find out, will I?
So what happens when someone walks through the door and you think, oh, not him?
I don't think I've done that. I haven't
You're
felt that way.
You're being very polite.
No, I'm not being polite. I would tell you because I've done the show about 17 times now, so I wouldn't have any reason. No one would know who I was talking about if I did feel that way. But I did do, and I'll say his name, because I did do a show with Toby Truslove, and I looked at him and I went, I don't know who this guy is. This is going to be terrible, because I don't know what he's like. I don't know his dynamic. The moment I looked at him, I thought, this is a disaster. Who is this person?
Well, he's a well-known actor.
And then I know that. And I thought, is this Toby Truslove? Because I've never seen him do anything. And then we proceeded to have the most incredible blind date. It was incredible. I was so happy.
But isn't that more of a blind date than if you see Jeremy Sims walking in or something?
I did
like
see
that.
Jeremy Sims walking in. Yes, I agree. And that's why I was so thrilled by it. And that's why I'm really excited about this festival, because we're going to have guests of the festival come in and some international actors.
For example?
I think. I don't know. But this is what I've been told. And so people that neither Tanya nor I know.
Yeah.
And performers we've never seen before. I hope there's some people with really bad English. That would be really fun.
You are playing the role of Anna.
Mm-hmm.
How much like you is she, and the other way around?
Depends on the night.
Okay.
It seriously depends. And the great game between me and the other guy or girl and the audience is that I can tell as many truths or lies as I want to in my creation of that character that night. So like I said, there's some consistencies to her. Like she likes a drink. She's very friendly. And she's quite nervous, and she desperately wants this date to work. Those things are given every night. And then things change. Like one, you know, sometimes I talk about being born in Serbia, and so the audience thinks, oh, she's telling the truth the whole way through. And then all of a sudden my sister's a prostitute and they wonder whether that's true or not. But there's a whole lot of different sort of games that we play and lies that I'll tell and truths that I'll tell, and that stays within the realms of my mind, I guess.
So you have to reinvent a character almost every single night. It's not like playing the same character. You could invent anything in your profile if you wanted to.
Well, I don't change my profile as much, but I do change the stories that I tell on the dates. Yes, yeah. I keep it exciting for myself and for Tanya, who are doing this every single night.
Yeah. So what does Anna want out of this date then?
Well, it changes night to night as well.
Okay, night.
And that's a secret. I don't want... Well, sometimes she might want to desperately go home with someone at no matter what cost because she hasn't been with anybody for such a long time. And other times she might want to meet the man that she's going to marry. Like she's looking for a life partner and that's what she wants. And those things are, it depends on the night and on the date and on the trajectory of the piece, whether that's revealed or not. Okay. It depends on what the piece needs dramaturgically determines whether we reveal those deep secrets of hers.
How involved do you want the audience to get?
I've never thought about how involved I want them to get, but they certainly want to get involved. They get quite vocal, especially with their laughter. Everybody seems to want to laugh at the most awkward moments because the show isn't about gags or laughs. It's really about being truthful, and then the comedy comes out of that truth. And the audience tends to give advice quite a lot, such as get away while you can, or oh no, oh she's so sweet, or that's hopeless, or you just hear these kind of things coming out of the audience. Oh no, what did someone say? Oh, he's left her. He went to the bathroom, and Tanya had this huge, long 3-minute chat with the date, and I'm thinking, what is she doing? They're just chatting away, wondering like what they should do next, and people thought that he had left me, and so had I. But then he came back to tell me that he was going to leave me, and then he left. So he didn't like me that much. The audience gets pretty involved. Sometimes they come to order drinks at the bar and stand right next to us.
While you're acting?
While we're performing, yeah.
Now, you've been in plenty of theatres, I'm sure, that the audience is so close to you, like closer than I am now.
Yes, that's my favourite kind of thing. That's my favourite kind of work in theatre to do.
Here they're standing next to you, though.
Yeah, but it's my show.
But can you tell them to go back to their seat?
No, because they're a punter at the bar buying a drink. So I just say hi, and maybe I'll flirt with, if it's a guy, I'll flirt with him to make the other guy jealous.
Wow, that is something that people should know coming to the bar to see it.
Yeah, there was a guy, actually, who sat, because there's a couple of stools next to us, and there was a guy who just decided that he would sit next to us. He just didn't want to move. He felt like it was great sitting there. And I think he really enjoyed kind of being that close to the action.
Don't you want to say to them, okay, back off. It is a bar, I know, but this is a performance and I'm trying to work here?
No, I prefer to use the things that frighten me rather than try and keep them at arm's length.
So tell me some of the other funny things that have occurred.
I've hit people, literally hit people. I've hit the guy. I've taken my underwear off.
I've got to get back to that because you mentioned it twice.
We'll get back to that. So what else have I done? I've kissed a lot of people or I've tried to make them kiss me. I've crawled on the bar. I've fallen off many, many a times off my stool. There's been a lot of fights. There's been a lot of tears. There's been a lot of real tears, like a lot of crying, you know, and desperation. There's been a lot of loud, declamatory, passionate statements about life and love and loneliness. And the other great thing that's happened, which doesn't really seem that dramatic and fantastic, but there's been a lot of really, really amazing awkward silences where we literally are stumped for what to say, and they can last for a long time. And they can be the most grueling and exciting moments to watch.
Why did you take your underwear off?
Because I was told to.
Yeah, but why did they want you to? Because this might be getting into a weird area.
Well, I don't know. You'll have to ask Mark. Tanya has never asked me to take my underwear off, but when Mark directed the show, he thought it would be a great idea. And some other texts that I got that night, because that show was with Peter Sargent, who's from Satisfaction, who is a woman. His reason being was that I was trying to look cool in front of her. Which makes sense. It made perfect sense. I trusted him and I did it. But then when we look back at the messages, it's really fun sometimes to read the messages. They went something like this. Take your undies off, put them in her bag, kiss her, try and kiss her again, kiss her again. Okay, put your undies back on. Okay, take them off again. Like it was just this kind of absurd physical action. The audience seemed to love it though.
It has a life beyond this. This could go around the world. Have you had interest from elsewhere?
The whole world has been interested.
Well, everyone's been on a date. Everyone knows what it's like to want to be liked or to want to fall in love or to want someone to love you.
Yes, that's why we love this show. Yes, we're doing it in Los Angeles. We're going to be doing it there. I've already started doing it there. In fact, we did two test shows, in one of which my feet were sucked. I've never had my feet sucked
who
in my life.
Who was the lucky actor who got that little moment?
His name was Chad. I don't know. I've forgotten his last name. And he was just so courageous. I don't even know. I don't even think he got directed to do that. I mean, I don't think.
Yeah,
that,
I'll bet he didn't. I bet he took it upon himself to do it.
I was quite awkward, and in fact, it's sort of. I still get really awkward about it.
Of all the people that you've had come into the bar on that date, one of them you were actually going out with at the time. How different was that show to all the others?
That show was the only show that had no structure to it. No rules. And in fact, we had to throw out every single premeditated idea of the structure that we worked so hard to create. Chris, my boyfriend, came in to do the show, and within the first 10 minutes, he had trashed the stage, turned into a sociopath. He'd come in as a beautiful jingle writer to justify the fact that he could sing because he's got a great voice. He'd trashed the stage and got pretty sociopathic and sort of became a bit of a sexual deviant. I decided that I would leave the date if it was that way. And so I started to leave the date, and he said, "You're not going anywhere. You love this. You're staying." To which I proceeded to hit him and to try and contact him, to contact Chris. I tried to do a Boyana to Chris, but his eyes were glazed. He was in character, and he thought that I was in character too. And, yeah, we proceeded to have a very, very strange encounter that sort of ended up being about two very sick people finding each other. Because otherwise there would be no show. But I did get violent, and I did cry a lot. He made me cry a lot. It was his fault, and the audience were there to witness it.
Did you leave all that on the stage, though? After the show ended, did you say to him, "Man, what were you doing?"
I didn't say, "Man, what were you doing?" I then hit the director, and I hit him, and I hid in the bathroom for half an hour until they unlocked the door and got me out. and then we all three sat and cried together and rekindled our love and friendship for each other. Mm-hmm.
It's a brilliant idea.
And, thank you.
You know, break a leg, it'd be fantastic.
Thank you. Come and see it.